Meeting will come to order. Representative Hillstrom, would you kindly move the adoption of the minutes, please?
I'd be glad to, Mr. Chair.
All right. Motion has been made to adopt the approve the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries. We're going to have a brief change in regard to the agenda. I would like to have a Representative Adolphson, would you kindly present your House File 2431, and you can move the bill.
I will move the bill, House File 2341. Mr. Chair, recommend it pass to the General Register.
Okay,
good. Also, in keeping with the hazing tradition, I have got some goodies here, and in light that you're Irish ancestry and we probably won't be meeting next week, we'll start these shamrock cookies around.
Well, very thoughtful. Okay, very good. Would you kindly state your name for the record, then begin the testimony, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Peter Adolphson, House District 42A. House File 2431 simply is a bill that amends a law that was originally enacted to accommodate title and mortgage companies so that their couriers would not have to pay for each transaction with the county recorder. Instead, a company could deposit money with their county recorder to guarantee payment of charges. This bill provides that the county recorders would no longer be required to, but would be permitted to accept security deposits to guarantee payment of charges. With me today, I have Mr. Ken Rowe from Hennepin County, who can explain any technical questions you may have.
Okay, very good. Sir, would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Ken Rowe, spelled R-O-W-E. I am an analyst in the Taxpayer Services Department at Hennepin County. I'd first like to thank Representative Adelson for introducing House File 2431. Essentially, this bill would make the acceptance of security deposits by the county recorder optional and not mandatory. Before going into the reasons, I'd like to give you a little background on how and why these accounts are used. For years, county recorders have accepted three forms of payment for recording and copy fees: cash, check, and what we at Hennepin call a security deposit charge slip. A security deposit is merely a prepayment for services. Anyone, but generally title companies, may deposit any amount of money in a security deposit account with the county recorder. They then submit documents individually at the cash register or in batches for later processing and include a charge slip to charge the fees to their security deposit accounts. When the account runs low, the title company makes another deposit. These accounts provide a convenient way to process a large number of documents from an individual source. Checks do not need to be attached to each document. The exact amount of the fees do not need to be known ahead of time. And title company staff do not need the authority to write checks at the counter. County recorders also do not need to send back documents due to insufficient fees, nor do they need to make refunds to title companies if the fees are in excess of the charges. Or excuse me, if the payment is in excess of the fees. The cost for this convenience to the title companies is the loss of the use of the deposited cash. The cost for this convenience to the county recorder, and ultimately the taxpayer, is the expense in providing this banking function. Currently, Minnesota Statute 386.78 requires that the county recorders accept security deposits. We feel that there are now alternative forms of payment, such as electronic funds transfer and corporate credit cards, which could provide the same convenience to both the title companies and the recorders while distributing the costs more equitably. As each county recorder acquires the technology to accept these other forms of payment, this bill will allow them to stop accepting security deposits and let the bankers do the banking. I ask for your support on House File 2431, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Adolphson?
Oh, I might add, Chairman Dempsey, that the banks and the title companies are okay with this bill. They have not voiced any opposition to my knowledge.
Very good. Are there any questions from the members? Is there anyone in the audience that would care to testify either for or against the bill? Seeing none, then Representative Adolphson renews his motion that House File 2431 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. That is the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you, Representative. The next bill will be House File 2694. Representative Wilkin. Representative, if you'd kindly state your name for the record and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Representative Tim Wilkin. I represent Egan and Burnsville. The bill in front of you, I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair, if you'd... it's the A1 amendment.
Representative Wilkin, would you just hold on 1 minute? We'll have a motion for the bill. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 2694 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the form the author would like it.
Okay. The members, you have before you the amendment, A1. You want to put the order in the bill that the author would like the bill to be. All those in favor of adoption of Amendment A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The bill is adopted. Representative Wilkin, begin your testimony then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is with regard to the governance of the Metropolitan Airport Commission. It raises the chair of the commission to the level of the chair, similar to the chair of the Metropolitan Council. If you've ever looked at the budget for the MAC, it's around, I'd say, $185 million a year, and that would put it in the top 10 of state agencies if it were indeed a state agency, which I'm not proposing, by the way. I've proposed in the past, but will no longer do so. But it seems to me that the political appointee, who the administration has put forward to oversee that agency, or the MAC in this case, should have be recognized at a higher level and be given a level of salary that allows them to really give scrutiny over the agency. This bill does that. It provides for confirmation after we put on the amendment. It provides confirmation of the chair of the Metropolitan Airport Commission by the Senate. It also does some cleanup that was done in a bill previously that I had last year, implementing some recommendations coming out of the legislative auditor's report, and I would request your support of the bill.
Are there any questions? Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilkin, what does the chair of the Metropolitan Airports Commission currently make, and what would this change allow the salary to go up to? And finally, has there been any discussion on what they would like the salary to go up to at this point?
Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Biskins, the current salary is, I believe, is $20,833. It's written on a memo that was some of this data was requested by the chair of the committee. It is unfortunately sitting up on my desk because I forgot to throw it in a file before I came down here. I believe the chairman of the Met Council makes in the mid-50s right now.
Representative Biskins, a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilkin, one of the things I've heard over and over again is that Northwest Airline is the funder of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. All right. Have they made any statements to you or publicly on this proposal to increase MAC, the chair of MAC salary?
Representative Wilkin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, generally my discussions with the airlines has followed that they're supportive of anything that will bring more accountability to the Metropolitan Airport Commission, and including we've looked at things like oversight by the joint commission that many members here serve on. We're not doing that at this point. I discussed that last year with Senator Rest. She wasn't really keen on that. I have pulled anything that was controversial from last year's bill out, and that we're not considering that. We're not taking off mayors of Minneapolis or St. Paul. We're really trying to focus on allowing a professional board person who is going to be the chair to have adequate compensation that they can dedicate the time necessary to oversee the staff.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Dempsey. Well, I understand the need and I think the goal of what you want to do. I just would like to know, where would the additional revenues come from? Did you say Northwest Airlines funds this council?
Representative Wilkin?
No. Representative Nelson, Northwest Airlines, the fees that are paid by the airline, the landing fees and the gate leases, fund a good portion of the MAC. But they also get a large, I think they call it in their hot dog fund or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, the lease revenue from the vendors at the airport and also from parking fees. So it won't come out of any state fund. It'll be self-funded by the funds available at the MAC.
Representative Nelson?
Just to follow up then. So, and are there enough of these funds then to provide for this salary increase without taking money from other obligations?
Representative Wilkin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I think $30,000 in a $180 million budget, I think they'll be able to scrape together enough dimes to take care of it.
Thank you.
Representative Wilkin, in your opinion, is a $35 million increase in salary a little bit much?
$35,000
increase.
I, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I do believe it's commensurate with the job that we request of the chair. The chair has outside duties. They usually have another job. These are professional board people. But the job is very big. The airport is a huge enterprise, and like I say, if this was a state agency, it would be in the top 10 in state agency budgets at about $180 million, roughly.
Okay. Representative Ellison?
Mr. Chair, I believe Representative Otto was ahead of me.
Yes, that's correct. Representative Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilkin, I wrote down that when you started your testimony, you said that if we increase the commissioner's salary, that that's going to increase their level of scrutiny. That will enable them to increase their level of scrutiny. And if that's actually something that happens when you increase salaries, I'm wondering if we shouldn't perhaps do that in other areas too. Is that what you meant to say?
Representative Wilkin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Otto, I think is a fair criticism, but I think if you look at the vast responsibility of a chair of this size board, I think it would be more commensurate with their responsibility. I just think it's fair compensation to for the time that is involved in looking at what would be a very large corporate enterprise if it was in the private sector.
Representative Otto.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilkin. I just think in really tight times, when many of the things have been cut and are going to be cut again, when we look at our priorities as a state and, you know, who has the most crucial jobs, this person probably holds a salary much higher than many people who work on a daily basis, who have very important jobs, whether they be educating our children, making sure our children are safe in schools, things like that. And since we're all having to tighten our belts at the moment, I'm wondering why the commissioner can't tighten their belt as well.
Representative Wilkin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Otto, this does not affect the state budget one dime. This is the MAC budget is, and the state budget do not interlope at all. There's no crossover. It is entirely independent funds. The MAC is self-funding. It is a huge enterprise. It's a huge economic engine for the state and the region. And I think it's would be commensurate to at least put it at a level where the Metropolitan Council is.
Representative Ellison?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, isn't it true that under present law, the chair of the Metropolitan Airport Commission serves at the pleasure of the governor and is appointed by the governor?
Representative Wilkin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, that is the case, although I'm not sure the term is coincides necessarily with the governor's. This cleans up that language. It cleans up the language so that all the members serve coterminous with the governor.
Right. Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Ellison?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkins, I guess what I'm assuming that there have been some problems with past chairs and their level of accountability to the governor, which would inspire your bill. Could you detail for us what greater level of accountability the governor will have over the chair of the MAC if your bill is adopted? And could you detail some of the weak spots of accountability in the past which sort of inspired your bill?
Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There, Representative Ellison, there is some confusion in current law about the other members of the board and how their terms expire. And this basically adopts, I believe this part was part of the auditor's report to clean up some of the confusion surrounding the term of the other members. Now, in elevating the chair of the board to a higher salary level, we expect more out of them. We expect that they'll be the act as more of a head of an agency, essentially, than previously it's been a very staff-driven organization. And having accountability, I think, means having the political appointees run the show and not have staff run the show.
Last question.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair. Representative Wilkin, that's sort of one of the concerns I have about your bill, which is that I kind of, and I'd like you to respond if you would, if you care to, I kind of feel like under the present system, the MAC is more of a political neutral. It's more, because it is sort of driven by staff and professional staff, it sort of serves regardless as to what political party is in the majority or in the governor's mansion. But under your bill, it would seem like it would be much more subject to political partisanship and not necessarily neutral and serving sort of for the common good as opposed to one party or the other. Can you respond to that?
Representative Wilkin.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison. I don't really think it changes that. The governor will still appoint most members of the MAC as he currently does or he or she currently does. And the members of the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul will still have their own appointees. I'm not changing that in this bill. So I really don't think politically it changes much.
Representative Lesch.
Your Honor, thanks. I apologize, Mr. Chair. Representative Ellison did that earlier today, so it's his fault. But I'd like to actually defer to Representative Hornstein first if he has something, because I had a couple questions, but also on oral amendment that I wanted to offer that was loosely based off of Representative Hornstein's amendment. It should be everyone's packet, so should I wait?
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I do have a question, Representative Wilkin, but I do have an amendment, and if it's appropriate to introduce that and discuss it, I will, but I defer to you, Mr. Chair, in terms of the flow of the hearing and what makes the most sense.
Okay.
Should I proceed, or
no.
Should we continue with questions?
No, don't proceed. I would like to finish the testimony,
yes.
And we have some people that want to speak in regard to the issue, and then we'll come up with your amendment.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right. Are there any other questions from the members? Then I'd like to call down Glenn Weibel. Mr. Weibel, would you state your name for the record and then begin your testimony, and welcome to the committee.
The name is Glenn Weibel, W-E-I-B-E-L. Chairman Dempsey and committee members, I'm here in total opposition to the proposal before you. The opposition is, normally a bill is going to fix something that's broke, or a bill is going to make a procedure more efficient or more responsible. In the current makeup of the Metropolitan Airport Commission, the chair serves, as I understand, they're asked to serve and they can turn it down. It has worked under this procedure for several decades. In the case of House File 2694, it creates another expense when the airlines at the MAC Commission meetings are complaining every meeting about expenses. It doesn't make sense. The airport system, as it is currently in place by this legislature, of one major and six reliever airports, is a very complex, complicated animal. With the changing of the governor chairs every 4 years, it probably takes 3 years for a chair to get up to speed, and we've seen chairs change recently much more rapidly than that. The staff at the Metropolitan Airport Commission, starting with the executive director, Mr. Jeff Hamill, is very efficient, very knowledgeable. The staff under him supports aviation. They are responsible to no one politically. They are responsible to providing the absolute best aviation service in the metropolitan area. I also have the pleasure of serving as the chair of the Reliever Airport Advisory Council for the Metropolitan Airport Commission. It is a total voluntary membership that is made up of one member from all the reliever airports. That council formed approximately 1999 in the year 2000, has met many times involving the members to solve and assist the MAC Commission and the MAC staff in matters as it pertains to safety, security, and finances, and we're engulfed right now in a very heavy financial challenge. The comment about the way it works now and it not being a political organization is very much true, and I would absolutely hate to see it changed, because while the open door policy that Mr. Hamill as executive director has, and I might add he is not in concurrence with anything that I am saying, and nothing has been coordinated with him. His open door policy is open to the heaviest equipment flown in and out of the metropolitan area, and it's also open to the lightest home-built airplane that flies in and out of any of the Minneapolis St. Paul reliever airports. He is extremely knowledgeable, and I think that commends itself from the standpoint that this system and the airport of manner in which it is managed has been the recipient of many awards both nationally and internationally, and looked at as a system of a model to shoot for by other metropolitan airports. I'm aware that currently there is some undertones of management of the Minneapolis airport. I ask you in all sincerity, as a corporate pilot, as chair of the Reed River Airport Advisory Council, and as member of the Minnesota Business Aviation Association, do not change the system. Leave it in place. It is working. It is not broke. It is efficient, and it's efficient to the point for the year 2003, this airport returned to the airlines in fees that they had paid some $13 million. I don't know of any system that's going to work better. The system has returned and operated at a lower cost than comparable airports, and again, it is a model system. Remembering it's a system, there are individuals who want to speak to an airport specific. We refuse to accept that conversation. It is a system. It is run by professionals that have expertise far beyond any chair that would proceed and fill this vacancy. In addition, the chair currently can speak to the public. They can speak to the governor. They can present information. But do not add expense or procedures that will handicap and tie the hands of the system that we got now that is run by true aviation professionals. I will stand any questioning, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair. I don't see anything in here about changing procedures or altering the system, how it's run. All I'm seeing is a change in salary, and I'm wondering if you could be a little bit more specific about what your fears are with this bill and what it is that you don't like about it.
As I understand, Representative Nelson, as I understand the bill, that individual has become the primary liaison. And I think that would be grossly incorrect to do. I think Mr. Hamill and his staff, as they go to speak to the community leaders and the aviation groups and such in and around the metropolitan area, speak from authority. And if I understand the bill correctly, it indicates that the chair would be the primary spokesperson.
Mr. Weibel, do you find that in the amendment?
I do not have the amendment, sir.
Oh, okay. Representative Nelson, the follow-up?
Well, I just don't see that. I was going to ask the author of the bill to explain that to me.
Representative sure. Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Nelson, this just codifies that in statute. The chair can really do that right now. The chair is in charge. This codifies certain responsibilities in the statute to clarify that staff bureaucracy is not in charge, that political appointees are in charge. And it kind of scares me to say that we'd run around and say that bureaucrats can speak for you know, as policy without any blessing from a political, either elected or appointed official. That's not how government works anywhere else in state government.
Representative Biscuits.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to echo Representative Nelson's perplexity, and I share it, all right? I don't see the evil that I think has been presented as part of this bill. As I look at the additional, or quote-unquote additional duties, which is in the bill on page 3, lines 21 through 29, I have to ask myself, what is there that you would not expect the chair of the Metropolitan Airports Commission to do? Among the chair's duties, if present, preside at meetings of the commission. Well, yeah, I think that would be what you'd expect the chair's duties to be. And I could go down the list. I'm not going to. But again, I guess I can't understand where the problem is here in change of procedure. I don't see this as any change of procedure. And saying that we would rather have Mr. Hamill be answerable to no one rather than be answerable to the chair of the commission is something that would concern me. I think Mr. Hamill does a wonderful job, but I don't think he's sitting here saying that he wants to be able to tell the commission and the chair how the MAC should be run. I think he's kind of comfortable with how this situation is right now. Are there any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond, there's no intent to make Mr. Hamill non-responsive or answerable to anyone. But the principal liaison for an organization as complex and sophisticated as that needs to have a total in-depth, broad scope of aviation. And I think as you go back through the chairpersons that have been at the chair of the MEC, with a few exceptions, there is not that there. And that is the concern.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Weibel. We also have Vivian Starr from Anoka County. Could you kindly come forward, please? Would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin your testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Vivian Starr, and it's spelled S-T-A-R-R. I thank you for the opportunity to speak about House File 2694. As a board member of the Anoka County Aviation Association and as an owner of a hangar at the Anoka County Blaine Airport, I would like to share with you some of the concerns we have about this legislation. We appreciate that the MAC chairperson and commissioners have an extremely important and continuing role in providing political oversight of the operations and development of our metropolitan airport system, and we applaud their dedication to public service. We fully support the concept of legislative approval of the governor's appointment of the chairperson of MAC. However, during a time when the state budget has a serious deficit and state employees are seeing their compensation and benefits eroded, raising the chairperson's compensation from about $20,000 to potentially over $100,000 does not appear to be fiscally prudent or politically wise. Please ask yourselves why and why now. The executive director has historically been the spokesperson for MAC on details of facts, and this is what we are suggesting. This person has and does answer to all. The importance of having an independent, modulated, studied, and authoritative spokesperson cannot be overstated. A nonpartisan executive director, rather than a direct political appointee, best serves the legislature as a liaison. The executive director's duty is to present facts about the operations, management, and development of the airports. Our current executive director brings a wealth of technical knowledge and understanding of both how our system operates and how other national and international airports operate. A politically appointed chairperson, no matter how well intentioned and dedicated, could not bring the facts and historical perspective to you and other elected officials that are needed to make wise decisions. Your system has won many, many national and international awards. It is a system regarded by its peers and its users as virtually the standard of excellence. Please do not alter this management system. Thank you, and I try to answer any questions.
Are there any questions by the members? Any questions by the members? Is there anyone else from the audience that would like to be for you to present information relative to or in favor of or in opposition to?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilkin.
If I could respond, this keeps getting thrown out that, you know, talking about the state budget, this is not part of the state budget. It is a totally separate budget, and I never advocate interspersing the funds of the MAC and the state budget. It'd be a disaster. The language in there talking about the chair being the principal liaison is common sense in how any agency would work, but that does not ever preclude the chair from designating a staff person, probably the executive director, from going to a meeting and representing the MAC. So the testimony in opposition that I've heard is seems to be a little bit off base as far as accuracy on how any entity ever operates within government.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Ornstein.
Oh, I think Representative.
Representative Otto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, very briefly. Representative Wilkin, I listened to the testimony from the gentleman earlier, Mr. Weibel, and now I need to ask you a question. And I think it was stated that Northwest Airlines kind of puts the bill for a lot of this. If Northwest Airlines is struggling after 9/11, and maybe I'm off base, let me know, but if they're struggling after since 9/11, why are we going to charge them more to pay the commissioner more when they're having a hard time? Like I said, we're in tight times. Perhaps that commissioner could live within the current salary, or maybe we can find somebody else that could live within the current salary just because times are tight.
Representative Wilkin?
Chairman Dempsey, Representative Otto, they're supportive of the bill. They, you know, when they go there, they're looking at the entire budget. They tend to haggle about millions, not 30,000, but I'm sure they get down into further detail. But I don't think 30,000 is going to be a make or break. And to have someone, I think the first gentleman's testimony spoke to the need for the bill. The complexity of this organization is such that you need somebody, you need to be able to compensate somebody that to the extent that they can really dig into this. Because it is, you know, I've been here, this is my sixth year, and I've looked at MAC issues a lot. And it's a very complex budget. It's a very large organization, and you know, I think we should have the salary be commensurate with the job we ask them to do.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilkin, will this increase in salary require the layoff of a single FTE at the Metropolitan Airports Commission?
Mr. Representative Wilkin.
I have not heard that suggested by anybody.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilkin, will this increase in salary or compensation to the chair of the MAC result in any fee increases to any of the airlines?
Representative Wilkin.
Chairman Dempsey, Representative Biskins, not to my knowledge.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilkin, will this increase in salary to the chair of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, which I think is probably appropriate looking at the size of the organization, but will this create any hardship to the budget reserves of the Metropolitan Airports Commission?
Representative Wilkin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, I highly doubt it. Any financial officer that couldn't shake $30,000 out of a $180 million budget should probably be in the new line of work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ornstein, you have an amendment?
Yes, okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is the H2694A2 amendment. And I have a handout related to this. There's a page. Mr. Chair and members, this amendment doesn't, while I have some concerns and agree with many of the members that raised some policy issues with the bill, this amendment does not deal with those. It simply states that now that the MAC appears to have found some money in their budget, that along with this you know, change and increase in salary and position, that we also use this opportunity to staff up the noise complaint line, which is very, very important to noise-impacted communities such as the one I represent, Eagan, Mendota Heights, areas south of the airport, St. Paul. This is a program that was initiated correctly by the MAC to respond to the myriad concerns about noise. Now, as you see in the handout, as of June 2002, this position has been vacant, and the MAC talks about the downturn in the aviation industry as one of the reasons why this position remains vacant, and talks about being filled through the end of 2003. Well, when I was woken up a couple of weeks ago at between 1 and 2 in the morning, I decided maybe I ought to investigate the noise complaint line, and much to my surprise and chagrin, I got a recorded message indicating due to staffing considerations, we can't answer your complaint. They listed some alternatives, but my thought was let's use this as an opportunity, again, with the additional money that the MAC has come into. Apparently there has been a change in some of the fortunes of the aviation industry. Let's use this as an opportunity to restaff up this position. My amendment says 24 hours a day. That's because it previously was staffed at 24 hours a day. But in consideration for some of the more fiscally concerned members, I'd certainly be happy if this were just a 40-hour-a-week position, if we could start with that, maybe 8 hours a day, so that at least during business hours there could be a live voice to navigate people who are impacted by noise through the myriad issues related with filing a complaint. You know, again, the MAC may counter by saying there's an opportunity to do that online. That's not always accessible to people. So it's far better to have a human being rather than a recording at the end of the line here. So while I think there have been some legitimate issues raised, sections, you know, 1 and 4 are the issues concerning the salary, and I would just want to make sure that this bill, if this bill is passed, that sections 1 or 4 are not effective until at least we can get this very, very important public and citizen participation piece up and running again. Again, I think it's very simple and straightforward. I would be happy to answer any questions that members may have or address those concerns.
Representative Wilkin, would you care to respond in regard to the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe a good idea, wrong bill. I would suggest that I'd be happy to work with Representative Hornstein and talk to the MAC chair and the MAC members about appropriate staffing at a line. I don't know that 24/7 is appropriate for a line. It'd be like hiring the Maytag repairman to sit there. A lot of the hours are going to be pretty much downtime. My community is noise impacted, so I have an appreciation for what Representative Hornstein's trying to do. But we could probably work this out offline with the MAC board.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, if you take a look at the amendment, the MAC could put somebody on for 3 weeks, triggers the effective date, lay the person off because the new provisions just don't go away if the position goes away. And, you know, I mean, to Representative Wilkins' point, the MAC has several hundred employees, and I don't think that we ought to be looking at that level. My last point would be, we had a special session, I believe in 1997, over salary, if you may remember that, Mr. Chairman, when commissioner salaries and deputy commissioner salaries became an issue. And I would say that what the Wilkin bill is simply a cleanup from that special session, that there was one salary that's set by statute. There may be some others out there, but one salary that's set by statute that somehow wasn't part of the bill during 1997. So I would hope that we'd be able to honor the author here, keep the amendment off, and perhaps Representative Hornstein, Representative Wilkins, talk to the MAC and see what can be done at this stage.
Any other questions? See? Representative Hornstein.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just I wanted to respond to both Representative Wilkin and Representative Abrams. And, you know, this is simply a way to say, to again, acknowledge that, you know, we have concerns about additional money being spent. It's clear this isn't state money. We're very clear about that. But it's the MAC appears, again, to have had a change of fortune, is able to afford this. And so this is a question of just prioritization. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be higher salary for compensation in terms of expanded duties. I have no concerns about that. That's something that the MAC ought to be able to, you know, have their prerogative to decide as an agency. But I'm just saying, as a question of priorities, if we're going to be doing that, then let's do something that's been put off, procrastinated almost 2 years now, that has a clear community benefit. The MAC did this because it has a clear community benefit. And if people, again, I'm willing to, you know, Representative Wilkin, I said at the outset, 24-hour a day, that's because that's what it previously was. sounds a little much. So I'm willing to, you know, I'll make an oral amendment to say 8 hours a day at this point to address that concern. But as we are, you know, allowing the MAC to spend more money, let's make sure, again, not either or, but let's do both of these, because this is, I would argue, Representative Wickham, this is an appropriate time and an appropriate bill to do this. And if there's some technical issues that Rabbi Abrams has raised, you know, we can correct those on the way to the floor. But I think this is the time and place to do this. And it is a question of just balancing our priorities, balancing our values, and acknowledging that this is an important function that the MAC plays, and let's give them the legislative okay to put this program back in place. So I would very much appreciate an affirmative vote, and if we're ready to vote, Mr. Chair, on this.
Representative Ornstein, why don't you move that and on line 5 of your amendment, delete 24 and replace that
40-hour per week.
Okay, so on line 5, it should read, eliminate 24 and insert...
And hour. Or 24, correct, yes.
Eliminate that and add 40 hour per week basis. And the week, replace the word day. We can incorporate that into the... okay, so is there any question in regard to the amendment on the 40 hours per week basis? All those in favor?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call on the amendment.
Roll call vote. All right. Roll call vote. Clerk, that has to do now with amending the amendment. Okay. So on the amendment. Call the roll.
Dempsey.
No.
Biskins.
No.
Abrams.
No.
Adolphson.
No.
Blaine.
No.
Broad.
No.
Eakin. Absent. Ellison.
Aye.
Hillstrom.
Aye.
Hornstein.
Aye.
Binzing.
No.
Lanning.
Absent.
Lencheski. Absent. Staines. Flesh.
Yes.
Mariani.
Aye.
Nelson.
No.
Otto.
No.
Severson.
No.
Soderstrom.
No.
Mr. Chair, I passed on the roll call, but I'd like to change my vote to an aye.
Okay.
Lencheski votes aye.
Aye, correct.
Six ayes and 11 nays.
There are six ayes and 11 nays. The amendment is defeated. We now have the bill in its original order. Is there any other questions? Biskin then renews Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call on this.
Roll call has been asked for. All right. Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, I still had a couple of questions and I wanted to offer a oral amendment as well.
Okay.
Representative Wilking, do you know what the average salary is of MAC employees or those who work for entities contracted with by the MAC?
Representative Wilkin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, I do not.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilkin, would it be fair, you think, to estimate that it's probably under $15 an hour?
Representative Wilkin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, I don't think it would be fair to say that because I have no idea.
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilking, this was something obviously that has a lot to do with the governor because the governor does appoint members of the MAC. And forgive me if I didn't hear it before, but I didn't hear the question raised. What does the governor think of this, or what is his opinion on raising these salaries at this point?
Representative Wilkin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, I heard by secondhand, so I'm not going to say at this point. The governor's going to have to weigh in one way or another himself.
Okay.
I don't want to speak for him.
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wilking, you had mentioned in some of your earlier comments that some of these changes, some of these proposals came about from the recent report of the legislative auditor on proposed changes, but I don't think there was anything in there about the increasing of the salaries. Can you explain how that came to be in your bill, obviously a very large part of your bill?
Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, no, it wasn't part of theirs. That had to do with basically I've watched the organization and I'm trying to look at ways to make it more accountable. I'm trying to make it less staff driven and more accountable and have a chair that is the pay is more commensurate with what the duties are. And frankly, I don't even think $50,000 or $55,000 quite does it, but this gives them some latitude in that regard. It's a huge operation. It's a huge responsibility of the chair, and I think we should recognize that.
Representative Lesh, final follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Representative Wilking. I guess part of my concern on this, obviously, and I commend you for attempting to make changes that way. I understand and believe that from time to time organizations need to be reorganized, as it were, and made more accountable, whether it's by restructuring of salaries or otherwise. I guess at this time, in echoing comments earlier, including Representative Ellison's comments, this is a really difficult time, I think, to do that. Not only are a lot of people laid off, not only are we in the middle of a strike by many other publicly employed individuals in the transportation field, enough ironically, over concerns and disputes about specifically health insurance, but obviously related to salary and compensation. But we're in a situation where over 1,000 employees down at the airport right now stand to be laid off in June wholesale because their management company has changed and the MAC has decided to opt for a different organization along those lines. The best that they were offered at this point was a job fair. All these people are going to be laid off, and we're in the middle of raising potentially salary from $20,000 to over $100,000. It's really tough for me to vote for something like this, unless it would just seem hypocritical for me to vote for something like this at that point, this point, and I think it would be the same for many members of this committee. Hence, I would offer an oral amendment similar to Representative Horstein's A2 amendment, but with changes in the following way: on line 4 of the amendment, delete everything after commission and insert the words, has adopted a card check neutrality agreement for airport vendor employees hired under contracts ratified in 2004 and 2005. As of now, the MAC has not agreed to even a card check neutrality agreement. Organizations, the workers, have essentially said, okay, fine, we're in this situation, we're going to be laid off. They merely want the MAC to stay neutral when it comes to being rehired and looking to get it to be rehired in the jobs that many of them worked there for over 10 years, 15 years, 18 years. So I would offer that amendment at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Would you kindly repeat the amendment that you are proposing and do so slowly so that assistant could get that in its proper order so we can vote on it knowingly, okay?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right.
The changes to the Hornstein amendment in this new amendment would be the following. On line 4 of the amendment, after the word commission, delete everything and add in has adopted a card check neutrality agreement. For airport vendor employees hired under contracts ratified in 2004 and 2005. And Mr. Chair, I would like a roll call on this amendment as well, please.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Representative Adelson.
Representative Lesch, as I understand your amendment, you're taking the Hornstein amendment and you're adding your words in and you're leaving also the manning of the hotline in there?
Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Lesch?
No, Representative Adelson. It removes anything about the hotline. I don't get too many complaints about the airport hotline, although I did vote for Representative Hornstein's amendment. But it takes out the hotline language and adds in the card check neutrality language.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Representative Wilkin.
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask the members oppose the proposed amendment. This is a bill about MAC governance and how it's going to be governed in the future. It's not about micromanaging the operations of the MAC. I'd invite Representative Lesch to talk to the MAC board and express his feelings about this issue or introduce another bill, but it's not appropriate on this bill.
Are there any other questions? We will then proceed to vote on the amendment. Would the... you take the roll?
Dempsey.
No.
Fiskins.
No.
Abrams.
No.
Adelson.
No.
Blaine.
No.
Broad.
No.
Eakin. Absent. Ellison.
Aye.
Hillstrom.
Aye.
Hornstein.
Aye.
Lindzing.
No.
Lanning. Absent. Lencheski.
Yes.
Lesch.
Yes.
Mariani.
Yes.
Nelson.
No.
Otto.
Yes.
Severson.
No.
Soderstrom.
No.
Seven ayes and 10 nays.
There are 7 ayes and 10 nays. The motion is not adopted. We have then the bill, and Representative Biskins renews his motion that House File 2694 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations.
As amended, Mr. Chair.
As amended.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Wilkin.
I don't know. Is GovOps requested it? They have. Okay.
Yes, they have. That's the question. Representative Mariani.
Sir, there's a roll call.
Very good. Would the we will take the roll call.
Dempsey.
Yes.
Fiskins.
Yes.
Abrams.
Yes.
Adelson.
Yes.
Blaine.
Yes.
Broad.
Yes.
Eakin. Absent. Ellison.
No.
Hillstrom.
No.
Hornstein.
No.
Lindzing.
Yes.
Lanning. Absent. Lencheski.
No.
Lesch.
No.
Mariani.
No.
Nelson.
Yes.
Otto.
No.
Severson.
Yes.
Soderstrom.
Yes.
The vote is 10 ayes and 7 nays. The bill is passed.
Thank you,
Representative Wilkin.
Appreciate your time.
The next bill is House File 1901. And Representative Adolphson, would you kindly move the bill, please?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 1901 to be passed to the General Register, or does it go to another committee? Representative Paul. Transportation, Finance.
Very good. Representative, would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin your testimony, Representative Paulson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I come before you today with some eminent domain reform legislation. Mr. Chair and members, the bill allows a property owner to receive, attorney fees if that property owner can prove that the fair market value for property is at least 20% more than was originally offered by the government. Mr. Chair, I'm just for my, there is a delete all amendment, I believe, before you. We should probably technically move before we proceed.
Okay.
Mr. Chair? I will move the amendment H-1901-DE2.
Okay. The motion has been made. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Okay. The amendment is adopted, and the bill is in the order that you wanted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Continue your testimony.
The reason the delete all was important is because we have already heard this legislation in the Civil Law Committee, and there were some concerns raised there, and so this is kind of a work in progress as it goes forward and continues to go forward to Transportation Finance. Just to follow up on the section regarding the attorney fees, is that the intent of the legislation in this section is to really serve as an incentive for the government to make some more fair offers and better offers for property owners right from the start of that process. And our neighboring states, Minnesota, Iowa, and other states, have similar provisions in law right now, and so we're kind of matching what they do in terms of attorney fees. The second section of the bill is the section re-clarifying what a public purpose is, and it says that eminent domain essentially for the government is to prove that the taking of private property is primarily for a public purpose in situations where that property will be ultimately conveyed to another private property, and that public purpose test for roads and bridges, utilities, etc., is not going to change under this legislation. But I do think it's important, Mr. Chair, members, to have a public policy discussion at the legislative level to decide when it is appropriate for the government to make the determination about when one private entity, one private business, is worth the government stepping in and taking that private property and deciding it's going to be given to another private owner, another private property. And there are a number of folks I know who want to testify today, and I'll turn it over to them, Mr. Chairman.
And would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin with your testimony, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alyssa Shalander. I'm representing the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. We represent all of the franchise new car dealers in the state of Minnesota, and we've been working on this notion of providing better, fairer protections for property owners involved in condemnation proceedings for a couple of years now. As Representative Paulson explained, the first part of the bill has to do with allowing property owners to be awarded attorney's fees after they have gone through the time and expense of going through the formalized eminent domain proceeding if they're ultimately able to prove that their property's fair market value is at least 20% more than what they were originally offered before having to incur all those expenses. If they're able to prove that it's more than 20% of that, then the bill says that the court may award attorney's fees. So it's important to note that the bill does leave the matter of whether attorney's fees will be awarded and how much attorney's fees would be awarded in the discretion of the court. And again, we're modeling this bill after all of our neighboring states. They all have a similar provision in their law, and the intent is for this to serve as a an incentive for the parties to agree on what the fair market value is before having to go through these expensive proceedings. Because right now, the taking entity really has nothing to lose by lowballing, if you will, I know that's a loaded term, and I know my friends from the cities hate it when I say that. But really, that is the intention of the bill, is to sort of provide a penalty for lowballing, because if they don't get close to fair market value, then there's going to be a price to pay, and that is to compensate the property owner for their attorney's fees for having to go through the expense of proving what the fair market value was. And then secondly, the second part of the bill is really why the car dealers got involved in this particular bill in the first place. In 2001, two of our members' dealerships were condemned by the city of Richfield so that the city could turn around and sell that property to the Best Buy Corporation so that Best Buy could locate its corporate headquarters at that location. We had a dealer that just thought that was the wrong use of the government's incredibly powerful tool of condemnation and eminent domain. And he fought that taking, and he fought the notion of governments being able to favor one private property owner over another private property owner. Ultimately, he did not prevail, but spent millions of dollars trying. And I bring that example up only, you know, not to say that we're here for some sort of revenge or something like that, because we can no longer affect that case. That case is done and over with, and this legislation won't affect that. But I only bring it up and remind the committee of that scenario because I think it's a good example of how property owners are at a disadvantage in condemnation cases. Here was a property owner, Paul Walzer, who's the president of the Walzer Automotive Group, who is a very sophisticated landowner. He owns 15 dealerships. He buys and sells property all the time, has, you know, ample resources to hire lawyers and make sure that his rights are protected. And he still came away from the process feeling like this is unfair and that property owners' rights are really, the law doesn't do enough to protect them. So our association is trying to change that and tried to institute some better laws to protect property owners who are involved in these types of situations.
And Schlander, would you kindly end your testimony?
Yes.
And I'll tell you why that is. We've got about 10 people that want to speak to this. We have to be out of here at 4:15.
Okay. I will end it right now. I'll turn it over. Brad Gunn from the law firm of Leonard Street and Dinard and Howard Roston from Melkerson, Gilliland, and Martin are here to help me just give you a better overview of the law in this area. So I'll leave it with them right now.
Okay. Mr. Gunn, would you kindly state your name for the record and begin your testimony and be brief, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brad Gunn. I've been practicing eminent domain law for about 22 years, and I would like to address subdivision 3A of the proposed bill, which deals with the primary public purpose issue. And I would speak in favor of that section of the bill, and I will briefly explain why I'm in favor of that language. Frequently, we run into a situation where the government wants to take private property from one party, one private party, and transfer the property to another private entity. Typically, this takes place in connection with some type of redevelopment project. There's something just at a fundamental gut level that's somewhat offensive about that and questionable whether or not that should be the proper role of government. And what we're trying to do with this language is to install at least some reasonable degree of judicial scrutiny into that process. What frequently happens when the government tries to take property from Peter and give it to Paul is that the evidence is presented to the trial judge, and the trial judge takes the position that under existing Minnesota law, he or she does not even have the right to look at all of the evidence that's presented and to make an informed and intelligent decision based on that evidence. Instead, the judges typically take the position that under existing Minnesota law, the judges are required to defer to whatever it is, the city or the HRA or the government entity, whatever it is the government entity wants to do, if there is, quote, any evidence to support the government's contention that the taking is for a public purpose. Well, governments have creative staff people, they have creative attorneys, and in almost every case they can come up with some iota of evidence to support
their contention that the taking is for a public purpose. So even in situations where 90 or 95 or 99% of the evidence shows that the taking is not for a public purpose, the judges will still approve the condemnation because their understanding of Minnesota law is that so long as there's any evidence, even 1% evidence, they just have to rubber stamp what the city wants to do. The language in Subdivision 3A will change that by simply providing that the petitioner, meaning the condemning authority, will be required to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the taking is lawful, in other words, reasonably necessary, authorized by law, and for primary public purpose. Certainly don't think there's anything unreasonable about requiring a government entity that wants to take private property from one private party and give it to another private party to be required to prove by, let's say, 51% of the evidence that the taking is lawful. Second thing it will accomplish is to require the government to show that the taking is for a primary public purpose. And that's simply to ensure that you don't run into situations where a particular city has a favored developer and they're trying to cut deals with the developer and give the developer a bunch of tax increment financing money, do land write down deals for them, and take property from one private entity and give it to their favored developer. They can do it, but they should only do it if they're primarily acting in the public interest. And that's the reason for the inclusion of the primary public purpose language. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next is Howard Roston. Would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin your testimony, sir?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Howard Roston. I'm an attorney licensed to practice law in the state of Minnesota. I want to echo everything that my colleague, Mr. Gunn, said, and I want to give two quick examples of how the current situation of the law is impacting citizens and people of the state of Minnesota on a day-to-day basis and why this is important. Both are cases that I was directly involved in, and I understand the instruction to keep my testimony short, so I won't go into any detail about them. The first one highlights the need for an attorney's fees provision in the statute. I represented a landlord in Dakota County in the city of Apple Valley, and the tenant in that building went to the city of Apple Valley and said, I can't work out a deal with the landlord to buy this property to extend the lease, so you should go ahead and condemn the property and give it to me. And the city of Apple Valley EDA said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. We'll do that. So they started a condemnation action, and I was hired. We tried the case for 2 days in Dakota County, and ultimately, in frankly a rare case, prevailed. More often than not, the landowners don't prevail in these types of cases. And at the end of the case, in the court's order, after the court found that there were conflicts of interest and the city acted illegally and improperly, or the EDA of the city, rather, acted illegally and improperly, the judge said, you know, I would really like to award attorney's fees here. I think that's the right thing to do. I think this landowner has spent a considerable amount of money to protect the property, but I can't do it because Minnesota law doesn't allow me to award attorney's fees, even though this landowner had to pay to fight a lawsuit that he did not bring upon himself to protect his own property. This does happen a lot, and it's important to have attorney's fees provisions in this statute now, so judges do have the authority when cities act improperly to award attorney's fees to landowner to make them whole. The second issue in the statute is whether or not the government should have to establish some preponderance or some evidentiary standard in order to take property. And I want to make it clear that the way that it's proposed, the bill is proposed, it does not affect MnDOT and utilities and schools and police stations and firehouses and things that everybody would agree are traditionally public uses. I represent, and I have permission to use their names, I represent Leroy and Janice Hanisch up in St. Cloud, and they own 5 pieces of property on the south side of St. Cloud. And a $300 million trucking company called Anderson Trucking went to the city and said, we want their property. And the city said, okay, we'll condemn it. We tried that case for 2 days up in the city of St. Cloud, and we don't have a decision on that right now. We're optimistic about the decision. But one thing that the city said to the judge in that case is, Your Honor, you don't have any authority to make a decision here. The city has determined that this property is being taken for a public purpose, and that really ends your analysis. And what this statute would do is say that in cases of redevelopment and development projects to municipalities like the EDA and the city, is if you're going to take private property from one private property owner and give it to another, you should have to prove that by preponderance of the evidence, which is the same standard of proof that we require in almost every other civil case for the party who brings the action. So I would urge the committee to approve this bill and pass these provisions, and I'll be happy to stand for any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions? Thank you, Mr. Rostin. Next will be John Schmick. You kindly state your name for the record, Mr. Schmick, and then begin your testimony.
My name is John Schmick. I'm a commercial real estate appraiser. I've been appraising for 18 years, and I'm not here on behalf of any property owner or organization or anybody. I'm here because this is the right thing to do. I can absolutely guarantee you that in the state of Minnesota, you cannot be made whole under the current system the way it is in eminent domain. Even if you win your case, the attorney's fees, the appraisal fees, the other expert fees will take a big chunk out of that award, and you will never get back to where you were. I counsel my clients that when they come into my office and say, will you represent me, first thing I tell them is, well, you've already lost money because you've been condemned. You can't get it back. Now, even if everybody tries to do the job the way it's supposed to be done, there's legitimate reasons why these things don't work out. Appraisers don't always agree on highest and best use. They don't always agree on the data to be used. They don't always agree on the methodologies and the techniques to use. And they don't always agree on what they interpret the impact is going to be on the property in the case of a partial taking. These are essentially civil lawsuits where the government is saying, we want your property, and if you oppose us, we're going to beat you up financially. That is the reality of our current system. And it's wrong. Government will tell you that they should be able to buy property for as cheaply as possible. Well, that's fine. Let them go out in the marketplace and do it. Their constitutional mandate is to make people whole when they are forced to give up their property. And that's not happening in this state. All of the states around us have some kind of a threshold test where it's 15% or 18% or 20% like that, that creates a level playing field that Minnesota doesn't have. There's no incentive on the part of government at any level to do anything but say, here's our offer, go ahead and fight us. They know how expensive it is to fight back. They know how expensive it is to pursue your constitutional rights to be made whole. And they use it as a weapon. Now, that's not to say that they're intentionally going out and hiring appraisers to come up with lowball offers. Everybody views the market differently. Everybody puts in different amounts of research and analysis. Everybody uses sometimes different data and different understandings of properties. There are legitimate reasons why appraisers differ in their values. The whole intent here is to bring the parties together to encourage them to negotiate. With this 20% rule that's in this bill, you have to understand that that's a compromise number. They're generally starting out 35 to 40% apart. And this is a threshold compromise that if you're within that 30 or 40% and the commissioner says, well, let's split it down the middle at 20%, you better have a darn good case before you go forward and try to litigate this as opposed to negotiating it. Now, at the last hearing at civil law, there was a couple of things that were brought up that I think need to be addressed. There's nothing in this bill that prevents any party from settling a case prior to a decision by the trier of fact. They can settle any time they want. There's nothing in this bill that is going to create any kind of a risk of a holdout of a property owner in eminent domain. State of Minnesota has a 90-day quick take provision. They can take the property and argue about the value later. We heard about very small cases. $1,000 and how easy it would be to get to a $1,200 threshold and you'd have to pay the attorney's fees. Well, if that's the case, if there's a concern about that, let's talk about a minimum damage award before this comes into play, maybe $2,500. If you don't get up to $2,500, let's forget this whole argument. There are ways to reach compromises in some of the components of this bill rather than kill the whole bill.
Mr. Schmick, would you kindly finish your testimony, please?
Well,
we're running a little over our scheduled time.
There's a concern that this bill will increase litigation, and I'll be the first to tell you there's going to be a learning curve. Initially, there's likely to be more cases than less cases, but in the long run, there will be less cases. If you look at all our states around us that have these kinds of reimbursement and fees, they spend less time litigating than what we do. So I would just reiterate, the property owner has to prove his point before this bill kicks in on reimbursement, and it's the government's constitutional obligation to make people whole, and that is not happening in this state. So I would urge you to support this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'd like to, is there anyone have a question? Okay. I'd like to have the opponents to the bill. Would Virginia Bell, is she here?
I spoke with Virginia
Dunn.
I thought she said she wasn't going to attend.
Okay. All right. What about Dan Clint? Mr. Clint, welcome to the committee. And kindly stay, say your name for the record and then begin your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Clint. I'm an assistant Anoka County attorney. I've been practicing for law for over 20 years now in Minnesota, and in 18 of those years with the Anoka County Attorney's Office. One of my primary responsibilities is eminent domain law. I have a different view of what's happening out there. I acquire hundreds of parcels each year. I don't always see it as a contested case. We're not supposed to go out and buy the property for the lowest price. We're supposed to try to determine what the market value is. The proposed legislation has 2 points, one attorney's fees, and two the primarily public purpose thing. Let me first, before I get into the attorney's fees things, talk about the primary or primarily public purpose. First of all, I don't believe it should be in this 117 statute. Minnesota 117 is a process statute. What the people proposing this statute seem to be trying to do is say, under certain circumstances, you shouldn't be acquiring this property. You can acquire it for a private individual. All the instances that they show are either EDAs or HRAs acquiring property for redevelopment or whatever and conveying it to a private individual. If this committee does not want that to happen, address it under those powers, under 469. Say that they can't acquire property to convey it to a private individual. Introducing this primary public purpose, introduce a test that the court has to determine with no standard involved. All those authorities, EDA, public port authorities, specifically state in the statutes that they can acquire. The purpose is listed in there for redevelopment, for soils corrections, whatever. Serve a public interest, and that therefore they're authorized by law to acquire the property. That's where you guys, the legislator, has determined it's a public purpose. If you want to change it there, not in the process one, because what you'll end up having is hundreds of different decisions across the state determining what is a primary public purpose. I really think that if that is the desire, a thorough investigation should be taken into what you want to limit the acquisitions for. Not put it broadly here and put it in the court's determination to determine what is primary. No definition of there anywhere. Now let me get to the attorney's fees. In this case, attorney's fees are awarded if at any time during the process the landowner is awarded 20% or more of what was initially offered by the condemning authority. In most of my cases, almost all of my cases are what we call strip takings, widening of a road, not big acquisitions like the Walsburg case. In most of my cases, the acquisition prices are $4,000 to $12,000. We settle, before we get to a commissioner's hearing, 80% of our cases. 80%. We give our landowners, or excuse me, our right-of-way agents, the authority to negotiate up 10% already. As the individual who was an appraiser testified earlier, there are legitimate differences in opinions as to what may be the highest and best use, how a taking may affect the property. And we don't get to know those things until you get to start really negotiating with the landowner. If we have to make an offer at the beginning of the process based on an appraisal that's done 6 to 12 months before that, just because of the timing issue when you have a large project, and then have to now pay additional attorney's fees on that, it makes the acquisition process very expensive. You could easily have, in a $4,000 to $10,000 condemnation action, attorney's fees of an amount equal to the acquisition of the land. What is reasonable attorney's fees? That's a tough one. I just tried a case in which our original offer was $22,000. The court commissioners ordered $29,000. We went to trial. The landowner wanted $144,000. Halfway through trial, I offered to settle for $45,000. The attorney met with the landowner, came back to me and said, no, I already got $42,000 in attorney's fees in it, plus the trial attorney's fees. The jury, after less than a half hour of deliberations, came back in with $31,000 in it for damages. Is it reasonable to pursue that? Who's going to determine when it's reasonable or not? The landowner is not going to be able to determine, wait, I'm running high in attorney's fees, is it reasonable or not? He's going to be left holding the bag if the court determines it's not reasonable, or and then the attorney is in a tough situation. He has to be a zealous advocate for the landowner. Does he try to limit that? I truly believe that the process is not broken. There are some problems. There's some larger acquisitions that people may not have liked. But if that's the case, do the appropriate thing and limit those powers, not put it in the process statute. And I truly believe that for cities, counties, and almost everyone else that's acquiring property, strip takings, the attorney's fees provision will add significant cost, if not 50% or more, to those small takings. And with that, I understand that there's time is short. I'll conclude
okay. my testimony. Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Abrams, you have a question.
One very brief question. Under current law, City of Richfield was able to say, we don't like you car dealerships. We'd rather have the Best Buy headquarters on this property. And three of five members of the Richfield City Council can make that decision.
Actually,
Or it could be four or five. Yes, you're right. It's probably four or five in a condemnation. Could you tell me, shouldn't there be somebody who can take a look at that decision and say, no, you're wrong?
Actually, the City of Richfield was not the one that initiated the condemnation. It was either the City of Richfield HRA or the EDA that has specific powers to acquire property for redevelopment purposes. Before they can acquire that property, they have to adopt a resolution meeting certain statutory definitions of blighted area and that type of thing. They made that determination. Whether that's right or wrong, the city made that determination. And if you guys want to limit that authority, then that's where it should be done, not the eminent domain statute, which affects many more things.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll just tell you that I've tried to do the blight test in tax committee because, let me tell you, you may not know it, members, but every one of you live in a house that, under Minnesota law, can be declared blighted, every single one of you. So, you know, don't come and say, well, they had to meet the blight test. Every property in the state literally is blighted. Blocky in Minneapolis is blighted. So, you know, don't say, well, we have the blight test, and then when we try to change it in tax committee, get the conference committee and say, don't change a word of the blight test.
Thank you, Mr. Clint, for your testimony. And would Tom Scott come forward? Is Mr. Scott here? Would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin and be as brief as you possibly can, Mr. Scott?
Yes, I will be very brief. My name is Tom Scott. I'm here at the request of the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm with the law firm of Campbell Knutson. We represent cities and municipalities throughout the metropolitan area, and I'm involved in the condemnation aspect of our municipal practice. Mr. Clint covered a lot of things on the attorney's fees. I would echo his sentiments. He's talking from a county level, from a city level. We, too, are involved in small takings, and I disagree that, in any case, cities are lowballing folks. I disagree that we have disincentives not to settle early and offer folks good valuation of their properties. We have all kinds of incentives to do that. It costs us a lot in the process in the way of attorney's fees. We pay the condemnation commissioners. We reimburse the property owner under current law for up to $1,500 for appraisals fees. I've never seen a situation where any of our cities have not acted fairly with folks, and again, most of ours are the small takes, the strip takes, the trails, and these attorney's fees provisions are going to add significant costs to those types of acquisitions. My most important point, though, is as the bill is currently written, as it deals with the second part of the bill on primary public purpose or the changes to the public purpose language, this bill as currently written would absolutely preclude government entities from redoing redevelopment projects where they reconvey the property to a private redeveloper, regardless of whether or not they can establish this primary public purpose test, because the language in the bill says that the final use of the property is for a primary public purpose. In the typical redevelopment cases, which cities are doing all the time, and if that's your intent to absolutely stop those, that's what this bill does, because the final use of the property, even if it meets the primary public purpose test, is not going to be for a traditional public use. It's going to be for commercial use. It's going to be for low-income housing. It's going to be in the hands of the private market. So the bill as currently written, indicating that the final use of the property is for a primary public purpose, would preclude any redevelopment projects. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from the members? Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Representative Paulson, the last testifier hit on the problem I'm having trying to figure this out. I don't have any problem with the attorney fee part. But that primary public purpose language, the current law is public purpose. I don't know what primary public purpose means. It doesn't define it in the bill anywhere. I know one testifier said, you know, it wouldn't be MnDOT, it wouldn't be these things, but it didn't, you know, say what it was. Then we've had some testifiers who are saying primarily public purpose, which to me would have a completely different meaning. I mean, primarily public purpose would mean mostly public purpose, and primary public purpose would mean the king of all public purposes. So first of all, if people are using different language here, that's confusing. You know, one is about a pecking order and one is about substance. The bill says primary, although some of your testifiers have been saying primarily and talking about a different issue. And I guess, you know, I'm trying to think of something in your district, Representative Paulson, because your community is newer than mine, but as communities age, I'm just trying to think about this. You know the place in Eden Prairie that's the historic home that's a coffee shop? Now, I don't know how that transaction went down in Eden Prairie, but you know, it could have been private, conveyed to I don't know. But if the city bought that and then said, you know, we want to keep this historic building and then let Dunn Brothers open up in there, they couldn't do this under this law. So I'm having a hard time figuring that out, because certainly through my own port authority and HRAs and stuff, we expressly say, go buy those dumpy parcels, clear them out of there, and for a public purpose, we're trying to clean up. Then we, you know, we don't do speculative real estate, but then we turn around and try to get developers to come in, buy it up, and develop it, and it becomes a private function with no public purpose. You see what I'm saying? So I am confused as to what's going on in this bill, because I think if someone's going to be losing their business at government's whim, they should get every dime. But part of me, you know, reading this, I think there might be some really unintended consequences here that the last testifier hit on. I think you'd prevent a lot of development that cities would be trying to do, initiating through public purpose, but ending up with a private owner doing something on that piece of land. So
maybe you can just comment on where this is all going.
I'll just comment
Representative Paulson?
I'll just comment real briefly is that I don't think this would apply to the Eden Prairie situation because Eden Prairie owned that property already and went into a separate agreement with the private entity all on their own, so it wouldn't have anything to do with eminent domain there. But this language was redrafted based on commentary in civil law committee testifying, and so I just want to make a brief comment about the direction.
State your name for the record, then, and begin.
Mr. Chair, member.
Representative Lincheski.
Howard Rostin again, and I'll respond briefly. The primary public purpose phrase comes out of a Minnesota Supreme Court decision, and it may, in fact, be confusing the issue too much, and it may be a word that needs to be worked on a little bit, as whether it's primary or primarily. We took it, when we were looking at these issues of definition, we looked towards the source, and that source was the Minnesota Supreme Court on a term of art. The goal of the proposed statute, though, is to say if you're going to take the property from one private property owner and give it to another, then it has to be for, whether you use the word predominantly or primarily or primary, it has to be for a public use or a public purpose. It will not put an end to condemnation for development projects. It will make the government establish a burden of proof.
Representative Lincheski, a follow-up?
Well, maybe just quickly, if Representative Paulson or his testifier could say, would you define this as a primary purpose? You're in a first or second ring suburb. There's some old intersections that built gas stations up to the edges. The city comes in and buys those free right turns to make traffic flow. The buildings are blighting, so the city comes and rips them down, okay? And the ultimate goal that they're planning to do is to bring in a new Caribou, a laundromat, and an Applebee's. Now, no one could say that's a public purpose. I mean, that's, you know, do you see, I mean, are you comfortable with saying that cities couldn't do that then?
Representative Paulson?
Again, Representative Lincheski, again, the intent of the bill is to make sure there's some qualifying standards there that protect private property owners that essentially are going to be taken out for another private property. And it's a good public policy discussion. And this is a work in progress, and so I think we are going to have to work through some of this as we did through civil law and as this goes forward to transportation finance. So it raises some very interesting questions.
Okay. Representative Broad?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my questions are similar to Representative Lincheski in terms of primary public purpose versus public use or final use. I guess I'm a little confused on the use or the purpose of the property. I almost think that the primary public purpose could be reducing taxes or expanding a tax base. So how does that play in versus a use of the property in terms of the argument?
Mr. Rostin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you're right in that the court would still have the ability and the authority in cases where the government can demonstrate a public purpose for the project, increasing employment, increasing the tax base. Those all may be factors that the government can look at and justify a project. And this bill wouldn't change that. What this bill would do would make the government do some work and prove that to a court, because what's happening now is the cities and the HRAs and the port authorities are passing ordinances saying we declare this to be a public purpose because it's going to provide jobs and eliminate slums without doing any analysis at all. In for example, in my case in St. Cloud, the government never set foot on the property before passing the resolution. And what we're trying to do is say to the judge, you have the right now to look at what the city or the port authority, the HRA, is doing and ensure that it's fair for the landowner, just like judges determine that it's fair for all sorts of other types of civil litigation where the judge is asked to make that decision. And what the governments are telling the judges right now in brief after brief after brief is you don't have any right to protect these landowners.
Representative Broad, a follow-up?
Just to follow up quickly, that argument would seem to have more integrity than from a city standpoint. To say, you know, we can prove this public purpose for a broadening of a tax base or whatever reason as opposed to imposing a blight standard and then moving a taking that way. And maybe that's a question for one of the city people at another point. I don't need it answered right now.
Okay, thank you very much. Members, we are running short. There's going to be another meeting. And what we are going to have to do is we will recess at the end of the session, and we will then reconvene in room 500 North at 5 p.m. Okay? Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it just to finish this bill, or was there anything else that we were going to be working
on? No, there are two additional bills to this bill that we are hearing at the present time.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Broad.
Mr. Chair, as a freshman member, maybe you can help me a little bit with telling me how I can be three places at one time.
You can't. Okay.
Magic.
We are in recess.
Blowing at this time. Oh, we got her up. All right, very good. Members, to continue this discussion, there's been some work and wordsmithing going on since we last met until now. I would like to offer, if you would please, the following oral amendment to the DE2 amendment. On page 2.
On the amended.
On page 2, line 11, starting with the word the, strike the final use of the property.
The final use of the property.
On line 12, strike the word primary. On line 12, between the words public and purpose, insert comma, not private, comma. So the new sentence reads, starting with the comma on line 10, the proposed amended new statement would read, the taking is authorized by law and is for a public, not private purpose. And I may not have gotten that right. At this point, and to the people sponsors of this legislation, there is also, we're going to need to deal maybe not, with the word primary on line 14, if you would look that over and offer suggestions in a moment. But at this point, I'll take any questions on the proposed amendment. Do we all understand it? All right. No questions. Bring it up for vote. All those in favor, signify by saying, excuse me, Representative Clinton.
Sorry, I had to take a bathroom break. Well, it's just been a long day, please. Okay. My question about the public versus the private, and not private phrase, would there be a conflict then, say, if we go back to the case we keep referencing, the Walzer eminent domain taking for the public use of the, I believe, anyway, my point being that public, it was defined as a public purpose because of the benefit to the tax, or to the city through the tax base.
Mr. Wilson, would you like to address that issue?
Sure. Mr. Chair, and I apologize, I can't see Representative Clinton. If I understand the question, it is whether or not this wording in the statute would have changed or altered the outcome in Walzer. Is that
right? I guess I am in questioning whether it's, I'm thinking in that case it still would have been defined as a public and not private use.
Mr. Wilson.
It is conceivable under the Walzer type scenario that the court would take this statute and look at the facts in the Walzer case and still conclude that the taking was perfectly legal and constitutional. What the key phrase in this statute, as I see it, proposed statute, would be the preponderance of the evidence standard, which really is intended to give the court authority to look at all of the issues and determine whether or not the municipality is proceeding with a legal and a public purpose or a public use for the project. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Are there any further questions of members of the committee? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We have folks on the list for further testimony. I'm not quite sure where we left off, so I'll just pick up here. Ms. White, is there Ms. Eva White in the audience who'd like to testify to this legislation? All right. Ms. Heller, is there Ms. Victoria Heller who'd like to testify? Okay. Mr. McCauley. Mr. Jim McCauley. All right, we're going through these testifiers in rapid order. Mr. David, is it Exe? Mr. Exe. All right. Mr. Larry Whitcomb. Is Mr. Whitcomb available to testify? Okay. And let's see. I think we're now down to Mr. Carlson. Mr. Keith Carlson available to testify.
Yeah. One moment. Bingo.
Mr. Carlson, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Metropolitan Intercounty Association, whose membership consists of 12 of the larger counties in the state of Minnesota. Five of those are within the traditional seven-county metropolitan area, and seven of those are actually in outstate Minnesota, but are members of our organizations because of the common characteristics of large urbanized areas that they share with our Twin Cities metropolitan members. We quite frankly are concerned with this bill. I'm not going to kind of plow over old ground on this, but I guess I do have to repeat again that if the issues that have been identified by the proponents of this bill are to be addressed, quite frankly, the sections of the law that they've amended do not address those issues. Section 1 of this bill regarding the award of attorney's fees, if it had been in effect when the Walser property was acquired for the Best Buy property, would not function to give attorney's fees for those individuals. It's the wrong section of the law to amend if that is the intent. It only addresses right now more traditional takings for transportation or highway purposes. As has already been pointed out, the second section really is a procedural statute. The issue appears to be whether or not the acquisition of private property for redevelopment or economic development purposes is an appropriate exercise of government authority. If that's the concern, again, the appropriate statutes to amend are found in Chapter 469. Whether or not the properties are blighted and reach the threshold where that exercise of public authority is warranted, again, you would find those statutes in Chapter 469, and those are the appropriate ones to amend. Where if you amend this statute, it not only applies to Chapter 469 takings, it also applies to more traditional takings such as highways, which is frankly of the greatest concern to counties. Contrary to the suggestions of the proponents of this bill, I would take issue with the fact that this encourages negotiation. It does exactly the opposite. One, because in order to get attorney's fees awarded or reimbursed, you have to get an award. That means basically you have to go to the condemnation commissioner's hearings and or subsequently to court. That suggests to me that any private property property owner looking to get reimbursed for his or her attorney's fees will know that I can't get them reimbursed unless I go all the way through this process. That will simply delay the process and make it more expensive. Furthermore, the cost of those attorney's fees are not inconsequential. I think I've distributed a memo. I think a memo has been distributed to the members that is under the letterhead of our organization. In Wisconsin, which has a law essentially identical to Section 1 for the reimbursement, their reimbursements for combined appraisal and attorney's fees on properties that have come under this thing have ranged as high as 22% of the actual acquisition price and damages of the property. That's not small change. For just counties alone on those highways which are part of what's called the county state aid system, we spend about $220 million a year for the acquisition of this property. If we had to pay another 20%, that means we would have to pay an additional $40 million. Now, if we had a gas tax that was 40% higher, such as it is in Wisconsin, and we had 40% more monies, maybe that wouldn't be quite such an issue. But given the paucity of revenues that are available for us to deal with this, it simply is not really financially in... It's of great concern to us. I could go on and address a number of nuances, but again, the bottom line is to address the issues that have been identified by the proponents, you have to amend other statutes, and this simply does not address those specific issues as it is drafted right now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And members, I will remind you of the words of Representative Paulson that this is a work in progress. If there are nuances with statutory reference, I'm sure they're going to be fixed up before this would ever become law. And so, you know, I think the broader policy is what we really need to talk about, not the minutia of where things should be going in statute. Little did we know that when he said it was a work in progress, that I'd be playing with his bill. Members, I'd like to offer another quick oral amendment before we take any questions of Mr. Carlson. On page 2, line 14, I'd like to move that we strike the word primary to bring the language into conformity with my previous amendment. Any questions? Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And members, are there any questions of Mr. Carlson? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Carlson, for your testimony. Next person on the list is a Mr. Dan Rosen from the Rosen and Rosen Law Firm. Mr. Rosen, welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Daniel Rosen, R-O-S-E-N. I'm a lawyer who represents property owners in condemnation cases. That's the overwhelming portion of my practice, and I represent almost exclusively property owners. I came here today having heard about this bill and read it, and quite uptight from the property owner's perspective about some of the things that I think this bill would do inadvertently to harm property owners as we strive toward the goal of providing further protection to property owners. And so when I speak to you all today, I'm speaking to the people who, like me, desire that the rights of property owners have much stronger protections in our law. And I've spoken, by the way, with Representative Paulson and some of the other proponents of the bill, and we'll be working together in the days come, hopefully, to cure some of these issues, but I want to bring them to your attention. First of all, regards the change that will require a proof by proponents or preponderance of the evidence of a public purpose. What we need to be concerned about here is that we're using a procedural law that won't actually change the underlying substance of the law. And by doing that, we may be causing an unknown harm, a harm to property owners that you may not have thought of. And here's what I mean. The substance of your law, of what is a public purpose, is defined elsewhere. It's not actually in the eminent domain statute. Chapter 117 is a procedural statute that tells us how you acquire property that in order to serve a public purpose, but the public purpose is determined
elsewhere in the statute. So, for example, you have a statute that says it's a public purpose to do things that are consistent with the missions of a housing and redevelopment authority. If you don't change that substance and all you do is you change the procedure, it's true you may get a closer look by some judges as to whether or not condemning authorities have really just dealt with it far too casually. But I tell you, you won't really be solving the problem. You won't really solve the problem of condemning authorities taking for what we can really realize is a predominantly private purpose unless you go change the other statutes. And what will happen, and here's the harm. Take a redevelopment project in the city of Minneapolis where you want to redevelop an entire block. Now, let's take the circumstance where it's a question mark as to whether or not it's blighted. But the condemning authority comes through and they make their findings and there are some old and dilapidated buildings and there's some new and decent buildings, but they've decided that they want to clear the whole thing. Now, under our current law, regardless of what you do with this procedural law, I tell you, the overwhelming majority of those, 99.9% of those are going to pass muster with the judge. They will be able to show by a preponderance of the evidence that they'll be able to take it, but here's the problem. You got maybe five property owners, six property owners. The greatest harm to those owners may be that their property is being taken, and it may not be. But the one thing that is harm to all of them is being held in limbo and is delay. Once that condemning authority says in 2004, we want to take this block, we'd like to put whatever there, and name all of your horrendous private uses for which private property is taken, a Target store, what have you, we're going to take it. Until they make their final decision and that property is taken, all of those owners on that block are put in limbo. They can't do anything with their property. They can't get new tenants. They can't sell it. They don't know what to do with their property until the condemning authority makes their decision. That is real harm, impacts them in their pocketbook from the very day that the condemning authority starts discussing it. Nothing in what you're doing will ever give them that money back. But if one of these property owners decides that they want to tilt at the windmill and use this new procedure that you're giving them to challenge whether or not it can be taken, all that will end up happening is they will delay the taking by a period of months or longer or maybe years, while the other property owners who don't want to tilt at the windmill are just held in limbo that much longer, dying a slow death because they can't get tenants and they can't sell their property and they can't do anything with it. And that is the problem with changing procedure without changing substance. Now, so as I say, I'm talking to those of you who want to protect the property rights, and those of you who, when you hear from the government, but gee, if we, you know, this will cost us more if we start reimbursing their costs, if you don't find that to be sympathetic, and I have no sympathy for that whatsoever. I'm talking to those of you who want to protect the property owners. Don't do it by changing procedure without changing substance, because you will hurt the very property owners that you're seeking to protect. Secondly, and very briefly, on the attorney's fee statute, and I think I may be able to work, this is a work in progress, and we'll be able to work to cure this problem, but you should be aware that absolutely it's offensive that a condemning authority should be able to come into court and hail people into court who have done nothing wrong whatsoever except to lawfully own property that the government says it wants. It's offensive that they should be able to be hailed into court. And the government should get away with not paying their legal fees just because the government says it's too expensive. Well, duh. Of course it's too expensive, and that's the reason why they need to be reimbursed. But the way that you're talking about doing it is a bad way. To set an arbitrary number at 20%, what you're now doing is you are inviting the scavengers in my profession, and I'm sorry to say it, but this may come as news to you, but we have some scavengers in the profession. I know, say it isn't so, but we do. And I'll tell you something. A 20% improvement in these cases is losing the case. I cannot think of a case that I haven't been able to get a 20% improvement. You all saw the testimony of Dan Clint, who is an excellent assistant county attorney, who came and testified before against this, who represents Anoka County. I was going to point out, the last case that I can really remember losing was a case that I had against Dan Clint, and I got a 35% increase. So, and you know what? And it was a loss. And 20%,
is nothing, and what you're going to do is you're going to attract the scavengers. They're going to come in and they're going to say, oh, all you got to do is take this guy from 30,000 to 36,000 or even 300 to 360, and it should be a piece of cake, and then I can make an application to the court and I can get my attorney's fees. And once they get to 360, their incentive to continue to work and actually win the case is gone. You need to make your fee provision directly related to the results that the lawyer achieves so that they never lose that incentive to continue to work for the property owners. And so to all of you legislators who want to protect property rights, please do it in the right way. And I pledge to work with Representative Paulson and the other proponents of the bill to try to help that. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Rosen. Are there any questions of members of the committee? Seeing Representative Quincy.
Mr. Rosen, have you seen the Senate's version of this law or this proposed bill?
I was at the Senate.
Mr. Wilson.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I was, Mr. Chairman and Representative Klinzing, I was at the Senate hearing earlier today, and I do believe that I've seen the most recent version.
Okay. Representative Klinzing.
I know that they changed the point at which. They changed some of the timing in the procedure language. Are there suggestions that you have for that, or were you part of the discussion, and what kind of decision did they come up with?
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Klinzing, I was not part of those discussions, and when I heard them, I was disturbed. I thought it took a poor bill and made it worse. But I was glad to see that it was not part of the proposal that was put forth to this committee here, and I hope that as this work in progress progresses, that particular change will fall by the wayside.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rosen, for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate it.
Representative.
Mr. Dan Thielen. Is Mr. Thielen here? All right. Final person I have on the list to testify then is Mr. Al Pint from MnDOT. Mr. Pint, welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Al Pint. I'm the director for MnDOT of their Office of Land Management. Amongst the other things I do, I'm responsible for the acquisition of anywhere from 800 to 1,200 parcels a year for MnDOT needed for transportation purposes. I don't believe we have any issues with the provision of the bill as it relates to the public purpose. I think with MnDOT it's usually fairly clear of our public purpose, and as long as this cannot be used to delay us in the delivery of the right-of-way needed for the acquisitions. I should say that while it's thought that MnDOT acquires large parcels of property, that's not true. About 40% of our properties that we acquire are properties valued at less than $10,000. A lot of it is strip taking in the rural areas, rural agricultural land or residential land. These aren't the properties that end up in condemnation. About 85% of our parcels are settled through direct purchase and negotiation. It's the 15% that are usually commercial or in the developing area of a metropolitan area on the fringe that causes us the most problem. Last year, this legislature passed provisions that I believe help facilitate the negotiation of land acquisitions with property owners. It required MnDOT to share appraisals with property owners. It also allowed for the reimbursement of up to $1,500 for a property owner to get an appraisal themselves. You know, as a result of last year's legislation and then the questions we were getting from the media, MnDOT actually started on a four-step process to review our right-of-way acquisition process. We started bringing in a team of FHWA and other states to review our right-of-way acquisition and appraisal processes in Rochester. We asked the Department of Administration to review our data practices processes. We're reviewing our practices against those practices of other states and industry standards. And finally, we've asked the legislative auditor to come in and review MnDOT's appraisal and acquisition process.
We believe it's much too early to start making significant changes in our acquisition laws until we're able to analyze the impact of the changes that were made last year. We believe they're working. The evidence we're getting is that the direct purchase agents are having an easier time settling parcels than they were a year ago before we were sharing appraisals. I think what we'd like to do before we make some changes that could cost the state additional millions of dollars in attorney fees, I'd like to let the existing process play out. The other thing we got to worry about is our role is really to determine the fair market value of property. That's our primary responsibility when we go into condemnation. We don't want to spend an equal amount of time trying to determine what reasonable attorney fees are, because that's what it's going to boil down to. We'll be spending as much time determining reasonable attorney fees as we do determining the value of property, and I think our responsibility is determining the value of the property. I think as Mr. Rosen said, and Mr. Rosen and I often don't agree, but I think his case of law firms out there marketing their services, we are now starting to get requests under the Data Practices Act for the list of property owners that we're going to be acquiring in the next year or two. Under the Data Practices Act, we have to provide that information. So law firms are already starting to market their services with the hopes that something passes that will help them get their fees paid. So with that, rather than go on any longer, I think I'll just be ready to answer any questions you might have.
Appreciate that, Mr. Pint. Are there any questions of Mr. Pint from members of the committee? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Biskins. Mr. Pint, I remember when you visited Rochester when we had the MnDOT hearing, and I guess my question is the same today as it was then. I understand that you're advocating for not awarding attorney's fees, and typically I take that approach too. I think we're a much too litigious society the way it is, and I would not want to do anything that would encourage that. But on the other hand, what is there other than attorney fees as leverage then to encourage fair assessments and evaluations without asking property owners to incur the risk and the cost of going to court?
Mr. Pint.
Chairman, Representative Nelson. I think the provision now that we put in there that we encourage property owners to get a second appraisal and we'll pay for that appraisal gives you two outside opinions of the value of that property. With those two opinions, you should be able to settle the majority of the properties, or at least set the boundaries on which you can work to reach that settlement.
Follow up, please.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. And I think we discussed this also, and the question is, who's going to give a second opinion in a city that's going to contradict another opinion in a small city, and especially when there's such a large percentage, like in the Rock 52 project in Rochester, where there's so many assessments, what assessor is going to want to buck the system and say, by the way, I think, you know, the assessment's off and this is a much more adequate assessment?
Mr. Pint.
Chairman, Representative Nelson. Well, in a city like Rochester or Duluth or Mankato or Bemidji, where we do have large takings, large in number, there is a problem with a limited number of appraisers in that region. That's not to say that professionals in the practice of appraisal can't come out of the Minneapolis or St. Paul area and do a good, thorough appraisal of property in Rochester, Bemidji, or Duluth. So neither we nor the property owner is limited to appraisers within the region. Anyone can come in and do an adequate appraisal without living in the area.
One more follow-up, please.
One more follow-up, Representative Nelson.
And I'm wondering on the, if maybe you can just refresh my memory as far as who pays for that second appraisal and what the ballot, I think, is there a limit? And it seems from the experience that I've seen in Rochester, it's often, sometimes it's a very large properties that are in contest, and I'm questioning if the, I believe there's a cap on the second opinion cost, and I question whether the cap is sufficient or if it's too low.
Mr. Pint.
Chairman, Representative Olson. There is a cap on the amount MnDOT will reimburse for the appraisal. That cap is set at $1,500 through direct purchase, and then the commissioners can award an additional $500 in eminent domain. Whether that cap is high enough or not, I'm not sure. The problem with a ceiling or limit is often that becomes the floor. In the past 6 or 7 months since this law has been in effect, we have reimbursed about 130 appraisals, reimbursed property owners for those appraisals. The average cost of those appraisals is just under $1,400. So you can see many times when we set a ceiling, it really becomes a floor, and everybody now is charging $1,500 for an appraisal done on a MnDOT taking.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Remember the bill we're talking about.
Right? That's true. I'm getting sidetracked. I want to just know if average is median or mean.
Mr.
Median's a big difference from mean.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Pint. Representative Nelson, that's average.
Well, there's three kinds of averages, mean, median, and mode. Which one are you talking about?
That's the total amount we paid divided by the number that...
That's mean.
That's paid.
That's mean, and that's a...
Sorry.
Representative Nelson, through the chair, please.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Pint. Appreciate it. Members, that's all the testifiers that I have on the list. It's typically customary to allow the author of the bill the last say prior to voting. However, the author is not available, and so therefore I would ask Ms. Shandler or if there's somebody from your group who would like to make a final comment, we will bring this bill to a vote and move on to our agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Alyssa Schlander with the Car Dealers Association. I just wanted to clarify one last thing, and I'll be brief so that Mr. Rostin can speak. When Keith Carlson spoke about Wisconsin and the experience in Wisconsin, I would just like the committee to be clear that in Wisconsin, the property owner has to prove that the property is worth only 15% more than the original offer, and if they do that, then the court must award their attorney's fees. That's substantially different than our provision where we allow the court to use its discretion as to whether to allow attorney's fees and how much to allow for attorney's fees reimbursement. I'll let Mr. Rostin make the rest.
Thank you, Ms. Schlander. Mr. Rostin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I will be very brief. On the issue of the attorney's fees and the attorneys being, I think the word used was the scavengers, I would suggest to you that you're never going to solve that problem in any statute, and if you're going to try to solve that problem, we need to start with Volume 1 of the Minnesota statutes and work our way through to the end. We cannot solve that problem in this bill, and this bill does not add anything to the fact that there may be attorneys in this field who are less than, I don't know, whatever word you want to use, competent. That's going to happen no matter what. I certainly don't defend that, but that's the exception to the rule in my experience. On the issue of whether or not this is a procedural statute or a substantive statute, there's two problems there. The first one is this: 117 does have substantive provisions in it. For example, in 117, I believe, 0.52, and I might be off a digit, it incorporates a Relocation Act, which does provide for substantive payments. So there are portions of this statute that are, in fact, substantive. As far as changing the rest of the statutes in 469 or whatever other statute there is, the practical problem with that is if one were to try to figure out the number of statutes that potentially give condemnation authority to various different entities in Minnesota, again, we'd be revising, I'd venture to guess, at least 40 statutes and maybe more than that. And I haven't counted, but there's a significant number of statutes that provide condemnation authority. And then finally, as far as the appraisal fees that the gentleman from MnDOT was speaking about, in most cases that have any significant size of property at all, if your appraisal doesn't cost you more than $1,500, you're going to get cross-examined by the Attorney General handling that for not having an appraisal that is competent. In the real world, qualified, competent appraisals do cost a lot more than $1,500 for anything other than perhaps a small strip taking or a single-family home. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rostin. Are there any final questions, members of the committee? Seeing none, we're prepared. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Rostin, I'm not an attorney, so I'm not fully getting this process part under 117 versus 469, but it sounds like the main objection to, and this would have been my question, Representative Paulson, is why not draft this to 469, because it seems to be kind of a major sticking point for a number of people testified against the bill. The major objection that you stated has to do with just going in and having to fix a number of other references across references. Maybe this is a softball question, but you know, the fact that we have to fix a bunch of other references to me is not a compelling enough argument if there are some pretty serious issues in terms of us monkeying around with 117, and so I just kind of want to offer you an opportunity to say a little bit more about the pros and cons versus going in that statute as opposed to using the 117 statute.
Mr. Rostin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I can't speak on behalf of the author of the statute, but I'll tell you my personal belief on that is it's not necessary. We can solve all the problems here that we're experiencing in one statute without having to go through the exercise of amending different statutes that have different reasons and different legislation and trying to make the different definitions in those statutes fit what the objective is here. Again, the main purpose here is to have the court apply a preponderance of the evidence standard to condemnations where it's going to be where the property is going to be taken for a development or a redevelopment project. And we can solve that problem relatively simply in 117 without having to go through and do an inventory of the condemnation statutes. Now, having said that, would it be feasible to go through and figure out all of those and try to handle it that way? It would be. I think it's unnecessary to do it that way.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question in regards to the Mr. Pint, who suggested that 80-something% of the processes are essentially taken care of outside of the court proceedings through negotiations, and that 80% roughly. You can help me with the numbers, but 80% roughly are less than $10,000 in value. So I'm wondering maybe your opinion on putting a floor in there or a differential in terms of the process for those larger situations that seem to be the ones in question versus the small street takings that many of the rural counties are doing in terms of accesses and roads and things like that.
Mr. West.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad. Mm-hmm. I haven't given any significant thought to a floor, so without presupposing what the author would want to propose, I don't want to overstep my bounds here. From my perspective and my belief, nothing in this statute is going to prevent cases from settling. There's still going to be an incentive for everybody to settle because there's certainty. There's a limit on the lawsuit. People don't like being in lawsuits. They don't like meeting with lawyers and meeting with appraisers and paying lawyers and paying appraisers. So I don't think this proposed statute does anything to change the incentives that people have to settle. As far as the strip takings that MnDOT does sometimes or what the member of MnDOT talked about, there are some very significant differences on damages for strip takings, and I would hesitate to get too technical on those, but there's what's called severance damages as well. So I would be leery of a floor on strip type takings for reimbursement of attorney's fees, simply because the example I'll give is I've got a case in Wilmer right now, and the strip taking that MnDOT did was something like $12,000 worth of damages, and we're going to be somewhere north of $600,000 by the time you factor in severance damages, is my guess. So it's a little bit difficult to establish a floor because there are so wide divergences of opinions of value. Having said that, the statute's a may. The court may award attorney's fees. So if the court thinks that the landowner is being unreasonable, you know, we entrust judges to make those decisions all day on all sorts of different issues. They can deny the attorney's fees.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your patience. I wasn't here at the beginning. I was at another committee hearing, and so I'm cognizant of language change that the chair moved successfully here. So my question is, this bill came to us from civil law as a referral without a recommendation. Was the language that moved, Mr. Chair, was that the bone of contention in the civil law, or one of them, or just trying to get at, you know, whether or not we should similarly be pushing this bill, if we push it forward, push it without a recommendation, not knowing all the parameters of the civil law discussion?
Representative Mariani, I know not the parameters of the civil law discussion also, but I do know the discussion that went on here prior to recess and those words being of difficulty. But Ms. Sharonda was in the civil law discussion, so maybe you could enlighten us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Ryan. The changes that we made with respect to the comments we heard from the Civil Law Committee were reflected in the Delete Everything Amendment that Representative Paulson offered, and then these, Representative Fiskins is right, the few changes that we made at the beginning of the 5 o'clock session here were because of the difficulty that people seem to be having over the word final use and primary, and we were just trying to make that more clear as to what we were really trying to achieve with that language. So.
Representative Franceschi.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank the chair for putting that language in. I think it does improve the bill, although I continue to have some concerns. And Mr. Chair, I mean, I also want to thank you for your assistance publicly last week. My car wouldn't start. Representative Westerberg came by and said, well, I can try to help. And I said, it'll start, but he went home. And it wouldn't start, so then Representative Nelson got out of the hood, and he couldn't get a phone. So then after another while, Representative Biskins showed up and took me to a gas station to get a tow truck. So thank you, Mr. Chair, publicly.
Why didn't you call the auto dealers?
Welcome, Representative Franceschi. I'll look to see if the bill is coming up with you in the morning. Seeing no further questions, Representative Adolphson renews his motion that House File 1901, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. The file will move forward. Thank you. And thank you to all folks who testified and your willingness to work together. That's what's going to, at the end, bring some good legislation. I appreciate those words that people are very willing to do so. The next bill on the agenda is House File 2270, Representative Adolphson. And Mr. Chairman.
No, I just want to run down there.
Can I use your name?
Yeah, I'm going to find out.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Representative Adolphson, welcome to the committee. Please move your bill to have it before us.
I would like to move House.
Excuse me. Thank you. Thank you, members of the committee, members of the audience. We are continuing our agenda for today. Representative Adolphson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2270 for approval and forward on to the Civil Law Committee.
Representative Adelson moves that House File 2270 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Adelson.
Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment, the 2270A1 amendment, to get it into shape and form we'd like to discuss.
Representative Adelson moves the 2270A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Adelson, to your bill as amended.
Sure. With me today I have Sam and Nairn, who represents the newspapers, and other testifiers on your list. I'll allow Sandra to go through the highlights of the bill, and then the other testifiers will come up.
Okay. Ms. Nairn, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sandy Nairn. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Newspaper Association. And just real briefly, I wanted to give you some background about this bill. Some of you may recall that there was other legislation in the last session that dealt with this whole topic of public notice publication. And the State Department's bill that passed last year asked the newspaper industry to sit down with local units of government over the interim and work out some compromises on a number of issues that have been vexing to the industry and to local units over the years. So we in good faith did do that, and I'm here to report on that. We had a lot of meetings this summer with various editors around the state. We sat down individually with the League of Minnesota Cities, with the Association of Minnesota Counties, with the County Auditors Association, with the School Boards Association, and we took suggestions from them along with a lot of redrafting of Chapter 331A, which, much to our surprise when we looked at it again for the first time after a number of years, needed a lot of redrafting. So the bill that you see before you that Representative Adelson has been so kind to introduce contains a number of the changes that the local units and the newspapers thought needed to be made to current law. And I think there's been handed out to the committee a one-pager that at least highlights some of the main points and significant changes that are made in this bill. A lot of what's in this bill is technical in nature, but the big things that are in this bill are Section 13 permits all public bodies to, instead of printing in newspapers, solicitation for bids and requests for proposals, lets them do that through their websites or through recognized trade journals instead. Some of them choose to do it that way. And this would be instead of the newspapers. They would not have to publish these in the newspapers anymore at all. Section 8 addresses an issue that mainly affects some of the metro areas, and this would permit more newspapers to be eligible to publish legal notices than are now permitted to do so by saying that those who publish at least twice a month would now be qualified. The practical effect of this is that there will be more newspapers, especially in the metro, that will now be eligible, which will, we hope, increase competition, drive down costs, let some more neighborhood newspapers have part of this business in South Minneapolis, North Minneapolis, and some suburbs in St. Paul, but it will also hopefully have broader dissemination of the public notices, which of course is our ultimate goal. Section 20 permits multi-year contracts to be entered into by local units of government. Right now, private businesses get the benefit of entering into contracts with newspapers, and they get price breaks for entering into multi-year contracts. Current law does not permit local units to do that. We're permitting it in this bill. Section 14 permits public bodies to accept joint bids from newspapers. More importantly, it permits them to take them apart. Sometimes there have been occasions where the newspapers have gotten together and submitted one bid, and that was the only choice that the local body had in choosing their qualified legal newspaper to print their public notices. This provision would actually permit them to take that apart and to say to the newspapers, bid it separately. We don't want just one bid. We want multiple bids. So this would permit them to do that. Section 11 is a mandate on the newspapers, and this says that any newspaper that accepts a contract is mandated to also put it on their website at no additional cost to the public body. Section 31 is a section that was requested by the League of Minnesota Cities, and this would permit small cities to publish summaries of their financial statements. For some reason, there was an inconsistency in Minnesota law, and the bigger cities could publish summaries, but the smaller ones couldn't. So we corrected that and made it consistent. And at the same time, they also asked us to increase the dollar limit on printing disbursements. Right now it's $100, so we tripled that up to $300. Section 7 was some of the language that was requested by the Association of Minnesota Counties that actually permits them to increase the minimum amount that they charge for, that they can assess against a delinquent property taxpayer for publishing the delinquent property tax list. We also spread the time between the two publications so that taxpayers will have a chance to pay in between, will have some incentive to do so, because then their name will not appear on the second publication. Section 28 is similar language to what we did for the cities on the threshold, and the claims go from $100 to $300. Section 23 addresses a problem that caused some inconsistency for the cities. They were required by law to publish their minutes sometimes before they had another meeting to approve them. So what we did is we changed it and said that now they don't have to actually print their minutes until 14 days after they've been approved by the city council instead of 30 days after the last meeting, which has caused some problems for some of them who do not meet very frequently. Section 17 gives the public bodies the authority to disseminate public notices by standard or email in addition to putting them into newspapers. Section 7 requires the public bodies who publish summaries to make the full version available to the public by standard or electronic mail. A number of the bodies that we met with also said that they thought there were a large number of other statutes out there that they thought were obsolete requirements to publish legal notices. So we thought the simplest way to find all those, since some of them were having trouble finding those, would be to instruct the reviser to do a search, and let's see if, in fact, there are many of those out there. And just by way of background, I will mention that one of the first things I worked for the Newspaper Association 20 years ago was a bill drafted by the Newspaper Association that repealed over 300 statutes that required publication of legal notice. And we did that because we feel that legal notice can't be justified unless it's meaningful. And if there are archaic statutes out there, we want to repeal them just as much as the public bodies do. So that is the context for Section 32 language. Most of the rest of the bill makes technical changes to current law. Some of you may recall there was legislation passed last year that also loosened up the public notice laws and permitted public bodies to select an alternative newspaper other than one that had their main office in that district. It was Mary Liz Holberg bill, and she asked us for this language. We drafted it and helped her pass it. And that has loosened up and lowered the cost significantly for many local units of government. I just got contacted by Woodbury City Council, who wanted to change the newspaper that they were using, and the law we passed last year reduced their costs by 2/3 because they were able to have more competition in the marketplace for doing that. That's a quick and dirty summary. We also have here Mark Amphenson, who's the attorney for the Newspaper Association, who can answer questions better than I can sometimes, so I brought him along to help me on this, too.
Okay. Are there any questions from the members?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
I'm going to probably offer an amendment to Section 2 of the bill, Representative Adolphson. Here we are allowing the county to assess a service fee. We're bumping that from $10 to $25, but then you read on, the amount determined by the county board is reasonably necessary to recover all costs incurred. You know, we had a bill where we've had bills dealing with cities in which their fees are supposed to only be the cost reasonably necessary for the cost incurred. So, you know, what I think we ought to do here, Representative Adolphson, is just delete greater of $25 or the, so that the statement reads, the county shall assess a service fee of the amount determined by the county board as reasonably necessary to recover all costs incurred. We don't need a minimum fee. Make it clean and simple. And we'll be treating counties the same way we treat cities. Equal and awful.
Mr. Chair, I would accept that friendly amendment.
Okay, now I need to get that.
Mr. Chairman, page 2, line 9.
Just a minute, please. Page 2, all right, line 9, all right.
Delete greater of $10, delete the new language or strike the and delete the, because the on line 8 would carry 4. So read, the county shall assess the service fee of the amount determined by the county board as reasonably necessary, etc.
Okay, does everyone have that amendment? Okay. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries. Okay. Are there any other comments in regard to the bill?
I do have, Mr. Chairman, Jennifer O'Rourke and from the League of Cities and Kurt Yoakum, care to make any comments on the bill.
All right. Would you kindly, Ms. O'Rourke, we'll begin with you. Would you kindly state your name for the tape and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I just wanted to offer a few brief comments on Representative Adolphson's publication bill today. We did work with the Newspaper Association and the other local government groups on and off over the interim, and I might add, in addition to what Ms. Nairn said, we consulted with the State Auditor's Office on a few of these provisions, too. One that I might point out would be the financial statements that they fixed up for small cities. And they were very agreeable to going forward with that change. So I'll just offer that for the record. And we'd like to thank the Newspaper Association and Representative Adolphson for dealing with some of our last-minute concerns in the amendment that he brought forward today. As you probably know, the League's had a long-standing policy requesting that cities be allowed to take advantage of new technologies such as websites, emails, to increase the dissemination of information to citizens and to potentially lower costs that are associated with publication. Some of the history of last year, a lot of us local government types were asked to come forward with our mandate relief ideas for legislators to consider. And at the top of our list, of course, because of our memberships, were things like publication. It's just a big expense for local governments, and they realize that that is the cost of democracy and doing business, but it's something that we've been glad to address this year, and appreciated the time that the committee spent last year looking at the issue as well. So I will leave it at that from the city's perspective and stand for any questions.
Are there any questions of Ms. Orr? Seeing none, Mr. Yoakum, would you kindly state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Yoakum. I'm a policy analyst of the Association of Minnesota Counties. Thanks for allowing me to make a couple comments. And first of all, I'd like to thank Representative Adelson, not only for his work on this bill and also the manager's amendment that he had offered, the author's amendment that he authored, because that really did take care of some significant problems that we had with the initial draft of the bill. As initially drafted, there were some very significant costs for counties, but the manager's amendment took care of that. But we'd also like to thank Representative Adelson for his work last year on the bill that he introduced, House File 1122, that is, to this point has gotten us this far. We've been able to make some significant changes on Section 13 of this legislation that allows for the electronic bidding. That's a start in allowing local municipalities to use technology in order to save taxpayers' dollars. And hopefully usage of that new technology or usage of this authority will hopefully make folks more comfortable with uses of technology for disseminating public information on behalf of local governments. So on that behalf, we would just I'd like to thank both the author and the Newspaper Association at this point for working with us. Like the League of Cities, the Association of Minnesota Counties has had a long-standing platform statement of wanting the use of technology for greater flexibility and for greater cost efficiencies, and this is at least a start in that direction. So thank you very much.
Okay. Are there any other comments from the members? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember last year, and it was, I think, similar bill deadlines coming up. This was late at night, and it was quite a long hearing. It was very polarized, and so I really appreciate Representative Adolphson, and I know how tiring and long these kinds of meetings can be, bringing sides together. Maybe it was your Navy background there, Representative Adolphson. You know, this is really an accomplishment, and you know, working together to get consensus, I appreciate that very much.
Okay. Representative Adolphson then renews his motion that House File 2431, excuse me, right, 19, is it? 2431. All right, 22. I will repeat. Representative Adolphson renews his motion that House File 22770 be recommended to pass and as amended, and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Is there any question? Seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion carries. Thank you very much. Very good. Next, we have House File 2522. Representative Blaine, kind of come forward and state your name for the record, Representative, and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Greg Blaine, District 12B. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move, as a member of this committee, I'd like to move House File 2522. Ask that this committee would recommend the bill to pass, and then I believe it would go to Representative Abrams' Tax Committee.
That's correct. Okay. Representative Blaine moves that House File 2522 be passed and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Begin your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll be very brief. I'd like to set a record today for the least amount of time I've on a bill in this committee. The bill we have that you had before you, House Bill 2522, is a bill that deals with clarifying language for township governments. This is a bill that members that some discrepancies were found by the state auditor and between conversations between the township association and the auditor's office felt that there was a need to go in and do a little cleanup. Members, that's what we're doing today. We're just doing some clarifying language with this bill to expedite the process here. I'm going to go directly, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask if Kent Sulem from the Minnesota Association of Townships could lay the bill out in a quicker fashion than myself, and then we would be willing to stamp the questions.
Okay. Mr. Sulem, would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin your testimony, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Sulem. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Association of Townships. What this bill is attempting to do is to clarify language in two township statutes. Minnesota Statute 365.43 is what's covered in Section 1 of the bill. The law, as it currently has been on the books, reads that a town must not spend more money in a year than the taxes levied for the year. The problem with that approach is that if you limit it strictly to the levy that's voted on, actually is being voted on in many townships around the state as we speak at their annual meeting, this is Township Day, is that when we collect things like our gas tax payments from the state, that's not part of our levy. When when we have a fund balance and the state auditor recommends at least a 5 months fund balance be carried over, and at the township level, we're not real fond of debt. We try to avoid debt when we can. where we know that there's something like a piece of a road grader or something that's going to be needing replacement, the preferred approach in the townships is that they levy a small amount each year for 5-6 years, save up enough money, and then pay cash for the purchase. A technical reading of the statute as drafted would say we couldn't spend that fund balance. This is an issue that our association has been aware of for some time, but trying to get the movement to fix it hasn't been there. And this year, actually late last November, we were contacted by the state auditor, who's also been aware of this issue, and saying it's time that we quit ignoring the statute and fix it. Because the conclusion of the auditor's office and the bond councils that they conferred with was that, by and large, the statute was being ignored because it had no practical input. We discussed options of how to deal with it. We were left with the impression they wanted to seek repeal, which is what we originally did. They contacted it after that bill was drafted and said, no, we didn't mean repeal, we meant amend. And the memo that you have before you now addresses that. So we withdrew the bill that would do the repeal of the statute and instead inserted the amendment language that the auditor asked for, tweaked a little bit by the revisor's office for consistency of law. But the auditor office was made aware of the language as it appears before you and had no objections to the revisor's tweakings. For continuity. So what it basically will allow us to do is to spend our revenues without limiting that term. Section 2, 365.431 talks about the tax for the town purposes must not be more than the amount voted to be raised at the annual town meeting. Again, what's occurring this very evening. However, there are a few limited exceptions to that statute that currently exist in law. For example, we have subordinate service districts where a limited number of residents petition the township saying, we want this heightened service. For example, we want our road blacktopped instead of graveled. And in exchange for you doing that for us, we voluntarily agree to pay an extra levy. And so it's only being spread on those people who have petitioned for it. The same would be true for certain special assessments and that sort of thing. So we're not creating any new taxes. We're not creating any increased levy. We're simply recognizing that there are other statutes already on the books that would be in technical conflict with 431 as it currently sits. And so the auditor also asked that we clarify that by putting in the language, except as otherwise provided. We're not adding any new exceptions. We're just recognizing the existing ones. And as I stated, this memo from the state auditor does support this bill.
Okay. Are there any questions from the committee members? Okay. Then Representative Blaine renews his motion that House File 2522 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. That's the issue. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative, and we stand adjourned.
See you next time.